content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Let me begin today by reading a note to the readers that I did not note last week. Note to readers, The Week will not publish an issue for 1 week. Your next issue will arrive in 2 weeks. Our next edition will be dated August 30th and should begin arriving on August 23rd. The Week currently publishes 48 issues a year. Subscribers, of course, are not charged for weeks in which there is no issue. And so, we'll be back in the same issue we read last week, and we'll go a little deeper with some of the articles we don't typically get to. And of course, this week is last week's next week. One main story we didn't get to last week, a new threat from Al-Qaeda. The Yemeni government said it had foiled an Al-Qaeda plot to blow up oil pipelines and seize the country's main ports this week, days after the Obama administration shut U.S. diplomatic posts across the Middle East in anticipation of a terrorist attack. Almost 100 U.S. government staff were evacuated from Yemen, and a total of 19 embassies and consulates were closed across the Arab world. Intelligence agencies learned of a possible attack on Western targets after intercepting a conference call between Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's successor as chief of the terrorist organization, and senior al-Qaeda figures. This week alone, drone strikes killed at least 12 alleged members of the Yemen-based al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. There is no end in sight to al-Qaeda, said Bruce Reitel in thedailybeast.com. The Egyptian coup and the ill-starred Arab awakening have created a new generation of jihadists in unstable countries like Syria, Libya, and Iraq, focused on sowing internal strife and targeting foreign crusaders in the oil and gas industry. Thanks to drones, poverty, and desperation, there are plenty of new recruits in Yemen. So much for Obama's claim that al-Qaeda was on the path to defeat, says Brett Stevens in WSJ.com. He mistook Osama bin Laden's death last year for a strategic blow when it was a symbolic one. He said staying out of Syria would contain the war, but that has allowed al-Qaeda to fester there and fan out into Yemen and Iraq. On nearly every measure, Obama's facts and analysis were wrong. We are playing a dangerous game in Yemen, said Gregory D. Johnson in foreignpolicy.com. The U.S. targets supposed al-Qaeda leaders with drone strikes, without diplomatic outreach to stem the rising tide of jihadism there. This is not a war it can win on its own. Until Yemeni tribal leaders and clerics are enlisted in the fight, al-Qaeda will maintain the type of power that sends the United States into panic mode. And we take a look now at a few short articles from a section called The U.S. at a Glance. From Graves County, Kentucky, McConnell embattled. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell came under attack from challengers left and right at Kentucky's biggest political festival last week, days after some polls gave Democratic candidate Allison Lundergan Grimes a slight lead in next year's Senate race. McConnell's main rivals went on the offensive at the annual Fancy Farm picnic. Grimes, Kentucky's Secretary of State since 2011, slammed McConnell for his obstructionism in the Senate. If doctors told Senator McConnell he had a kidney stone, he'd refuse to pass it, she quipped. Tea Party Allied businessman Matt Bevin, who will challenge McConnell in next year's Republican primary, told the crowd he wouldn't run to the right of the senator, but straight over the top of him. McConnell did not rise to the bait, limiting his own criticism to President Obama. Public policy polling gave Grimes a one-point lead over the four-term senator last week. From Venice Beach, California, car rampage. A man has been charged with murder after allegedly plowing a car into a crowd on the Venice Beach boardwalk last week, killing one and injuring 16 others. Officials say that Nathan Lewis Campbell, 38, drove a Dodge Avenger onto a boardwalk before accelerating to almost 60 miles per hour, sending beachgoers and vendors diving for cover. The car struck and killed Italian tourist Alice Gruppioni, 32, who was visiting California on her honeymoon. "It was horrible," said one witness. "It was like something out of a movie, something you could never expect to see." Campbell turned himself into Santa Monica police shortly after the rampage and has also been charged with 16 counts of assault with a deadly weapon and 17 counts of hit and run. Campbell had a history of arrest in Colorado and Florida, including a reckless driving arrest involving alcohol in Panama City Beach in 2008. From Columbus, Ohio, death row suicide. A death row convict due to be executed for murder hanged himself in his prison cell this week, unaware of a last-minute appeal that might have saved his life. Authorities found the body of Billy Slagle, 44, at the Chillicothe Correctional Institution south of Columbus, 3 days before he was due to be executed for the 1987 murder of Marie Ann Pope. Slagle died without knowing that his lawyers were preparing a new appeal that might have stayed his execution. The attorneys discovered that Slagle had been offered a plea deal to escape the death penalty by prosecutors in 1988, but his then lawyers never presented it to him. The state had indicated it would not oppose the appeal. From Dallas, Bush surgery. Former President George W. Bush was in high spirits after undergoing heart surgery on a blocked artery this week, according to his spokesman. Doctors discovered the blockage during Bush's annual physical and recommended that a stent be inserted to prop open the artery. The procedure at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital went off without complication, spokesman Freddie Ford said. Bush was physically active during his two terms in the White House, running regularly before knee problems led him to take up bicycling instead. Since leaving office, he has hosted an annual 62-mile mountain bike ride for wounded troops and is due to host a charity golf tournament in late September. And a few more short articles from a section called The World at a Glance. From Gibraltar, Spain threatens blockade. A dispute between Spain and Gibraltar over fishing rights could turn into an economic blockade of the tiny British territory at the entrance of the Mediterranean. The spat began 2 weeks ago when boats from Gibraltar dropped concrete blocks into the sea to create a reef as a fish habitat. Spain complained that the reef would block its fishing boats and imposed border checks in retaliation, slowing traffic and trade onto the peninsula and forcing Gibraltarians to wait for hours in searing heat to cross to their homes. As the dispute escalated, Spain threatened to impose fees to cross the border. Fabian Picardo, chief minister of Gibraltar, said Spanish leaders were behaving like erratic dictators. "The Spanish have always claimed rights to Gibraltar's waters that they don't have," he said. From Bogota, Colombia, river blindness gone. Colombia has become the first country in the world to clear its territory of the pathogen that causes river blindness. The insect-borne disease, Onchocerciasis is endemic in Latin America and much of Africa, and it had a stronghold in western Colombia until health workers from the UN and the Carter Center began administering antiparasitic drugs in the affected area every 6 months starting in 1993. Colombia's achievement demonstrates that a future free from river blindness is possible for everyone in the Americas, said former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. From Montevideo in Uruguay, the state as dealer. Uruguay has created the world's first state-run market for non-medical marijuana. In an effort to kill off the criminal drug trade by robbing it of its market, the parliament last week voted to legalize the drug and set up government regulation to produce and distribute it at a price of about $2.50 a gram, the cheaper end of the street rate. Consumers will have to register with the state to buy the drug at pharmacies and will be limited to 40 grams a month for personal use. Officials hope that since the state pot will be guaranteed to be fresh and pure, users will opt to purchase from the government rather than the black market. From Tehran, Rouhani's new start. Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, is calling for a dialogue with the U.S. Sworn in this week, the moderate cleric, who overwhelmingly won elections in June, said Iran wanted new negotiations over its nuclear program. "What matters to us is a practical response from the U.S. government, not statements," he said. "If we feel that the Americans are truly serious about resolving problems, Iran is serious." Rouhani has taken the first step by choosing as his foreign minister a former UN ambassador with strong American ties, fluent in English and well-known in Washington. Mohammad Javad Zarif received a doctorate from the University of Denver, and his children were born in the U.S. From Delhi, welfare for all. India's government has introduced a plan to subsidize food for two-thirds of the country's population. The $4 billion a year program, a campaign promised by the ruling Congress Party, will provide 11 pounds of deeply discounted rice, wheat, and millet a month to nearly 800 million poor people. India has one-third of the world's poor people, and nearly half of Indian children under age 5 are malnourished. But the program is being hotly debated. Some critics say the grain won't reach the poor, as it is to be distributed through chronically corrupt state-owned shops, while others say the allotment isn't enough to relieve hunger. On the People page, here's a short article about actor Anthony Hopkins. Hopkins' antisocial behavior. "Once a notorious boozer, Anthony Hopkins now leads a quiet life," said Gabrielle Donnelly in the Daily Mail. The actor lives in Malibu, where he paints, plays the piano, and walks on the beach. "I am happy," said Hopkins, 75, whatever that means. He credits his third wife, Colombian-born Stella Arroyave, 57, with teaching him to slow down and appreciate life. "She's a wonderful woman who likes to spend my money, but she's very good for me. My nature is to do things very fast because I think I'm still 45 years old. I walk too fast and I'm always falling over, and she reminds me not to." When Hopkins isn't working, the couple keep to themselves. "We have people over for dinner sometimes, and that's pretty nice. But at the end of the meal, when you've said all you had to say, what do you do with them then?" Stella does warn them. She says, "Tony's very odd. He'll get up and go to bed if he gets bored. He never invites actors to his house. They're the worst. They've got nothing to talk about but old movies. And yet, on set, they're always saying, 'Let's get together. Let's have dinner.' Someone said that to Meryl Streep once, and she just said, Why? I don't even know you. We'll take a look now at some best columns. Instead of from the U.S., we'll look at best columns from Europe. This comes from the United Kingdom, from Giles Corran of the Times. They were lying to us all along, said Giles Corran. Back in the 1980s, when I was a teen at the height of the Cold War, British officials assured us that we didn't have to worry about nuclear Armageddon because the principle of mutually assured destruction would save us. They told me the Russians loved their children too. But now it turns out that they had secretly written a speech for the Queen to read out in the event that the missiles were hurtling toward us. It has just been published under the terrifying S that can be published after 30 years later law. What's scary isn't so much that the realization that we were close enough to nuclear war for a contingency speech. It's the hollowness of the words. The Queen reminds us that we survived World War II and then signs off with the most bone-chilling words of our English language has to call upon. God bless you all. That, as any native speaker knows, is just another way of saying, all hope is lost, we're totally screwed. Worst of all, the Queen didn't even write the words herself. How little consolation there will be in the next calamity, now that we know the monarch's exhortation to keep a stiff upper lip is prescripted, pre-recorded, unfelt, unmeant, and scribbled by flunkies. And from Italy, Alexander Stell of La Repubblica writes, "It's a miracle," said Alexander Stell. "Justice has finally caught up with Silvio Berlusconi. The Supreme Court has struck down the former Prime Minister's final appeal in one of his many tax fraud cases and sentenced him to incarceration. It's not as harsh as it could be, of course, because of laws Berlusconi rammed through in the past to protect a business associate convicted of bribing judges on his behalf. The sentence will be automatically chopped down from 4 years to one, to be served in comfort at Berlusconi's own villa, or even commuted to community service. Still, a conviction upheld. It's hard to underscore how shocking this is. The Italian system scarcely ever speaks so clearly as to say definitively that a defendant is guilty and his punishment is X. It usually leaves plenty of room for further legal shenanigans. Berlusconi wiggled out of multiple previous convictions for bribery and fraud, despite even more overwhelming evidence, by delaying proceedings until the statute of limitations ran out, or finding some arcane pretext to remove the case from the judge's jurisdiction. Everyone has his price. That was the cynical, nihilistic philosophy that governed our leader and, by extension, the country. Have we finally reached a post-Berlusconi era when justice is no longer negotiable?" In international news, we have an article from Russia. Will gays be welcome at the Olympics? Gay athletes who compete in next February's Winter Olympics could be arrested, said Sean Walker in The Independent. The games are to be held in the Black Sea port of Sochi in Russia, which has a new law banning homosexual propaganda around minors. The International Olympic Committee said that it had received assurances from the Russian government that gay athletes would not be targeted. But last week, Russian sports minister Vitaly Mutko gave an unequivocal rejection to the idea of impunity. "An athlete of non-traditional sexual orientation isn't banned from coming to Sochi," Mutko said. "But if he goes out into the streets and starts to propagandize, then of course he will be held accountable." Police have been interpreting the vaguely worded law broadly, arresting people for holding signs calling for equal rights for gays. Russian gay activists are calling on Olympians to wear rainbow pins in protest. But given Mutko's statement, this could lead to mass arrest. "Don't be ridiculous," said Sergei Frolov in Trud, T-R-U-D, that's a Russian periodical. "The law simply forbids people from trying to persuade teenagers to enter into unconventional sexual relationships. One would assume that even gay athletes would be coming to the games hoping to win medals, not recruits. But of course, this demonization of Russia was to be expected. Westerners are upset at Russia slapping America in the face by giving asylum to whistleblower Edward Snowden. Their newspapers have been comparing President Vladimir Putin to Hitler and Sochi to the 1936 Games in Berlin, as if a gay athlete were the equivalent of Jesse Owens. In reality, this anti-gay orgy has backfired. Now more people than ever before see Russia as the last bastion of normal Christian morality. With this law, Russia has placed itself outside the world mainstream, and so has the International Olympic Committee," says Volker Kriesel in Süddeutsche Zeitung. "In a time when openly gay soccer players are being welcomed by fans in many countries, and even the Pope says he can't judge homosexuals, the Olympics are being held in a land that persecutes gays. The IOC is supposed to exist to promote tolerance and understanding among peoples, but don't expect it to stand up for its principles. It already showed it was willing to knuckle under to an authoritarian regime in 2008 Beijing Games, where even the press had only limited access to the Internet." Canada, at least, has spoken out, said Celine Cooper in the Montreal Gazette. "Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird called the Russian ban a mean-spirited and hateful law that flies in the face of the entire Olympic spirit. So how should athletes show solidarity with Russia's beleaguered gays? Not by dumping vodka down the sewers, as some protesters suggest. Stolny is made in Latvia, after all, and its Russian owner is no friend of Putin's regime. Nor by an Olympic boycott, which only punishes the athletes. Instead, athletes and press and the press should do what Russian activists are asking of them. Show up to lend support, legitimacy, and credibility to Russia's LGBT community." Here's one of the best international columns from India. This is by Fabian von Poser of Die Welt from Germany. "Millions of Indians still live in desperate poverty with no chance of bettering themselves," said Fabian von Poser. "While the caste system is no longer as rigid as it was a century ago, it still determines the destiny of millions. In Mumbai, for example, almost everyone who works at the world's biggest laundry, Dhobi Ghat, comes from the Dhobi, the washerman caste. Some 5,000 men work there 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, scrubbing uniforms, sheets, and towels for the city's hotels and restaurants, and pounding them dry on rocks. Some have worked there every day since age 13, earning barely enough money to cover the rent on a room shared with a dozen others. Many have accepted the fact that there is no escape. With no pension and no possibility of saving, they will work until they die, or become so disabled that they can no longer lift the wash basins. Washers often suffer acid burns on hands and feet from using chemical-laden cleaning solutions. But since they have no health insurance, they can't get treatment. Yet they see themselves as the lucky ones. I at least have some money for food and a roof over my head," says one washerman. "Many others in the city don't have that." Another international column from Nigeria. It's an editorial from the periodical Leadership. Nigeria has etched its name in football's Hall of Infamy, said leadership. The sport in our country is entirely corrupted by pervasive match fixing, and we all know that an away team has almost no chance of winning a game. Still, the blatant cheating last month was truly breathtaking. Plateau United Feeders and Police Machine were each vying in separate matches for a single spot in the professional league, and whichever team got the most goals in the final game would clinch it. The two games became frenzies of fake goal scoring, as each team's opponent simply left the goal unattended so the predetermined winners could pitch in ball after ball. One game ended with the lopsided score of 67-0, and the other came to the painful end of 79-0. Preposterous outcomes that required shooting a goal roughly every 40 seconds. The Nigerian Football Federation has pronounced a lifetime ban on all the players and coaches of the four teams involved. But that's not enough. The cheaters should be formally prosecuted in a competent court of law. In other football-mad countries like those of South America, the sport is a legitimate industry that earns foreign currency. In Nigeria, it's just another opportunity for corruption. And we'll take a little side trip this week to the travel page. This week's dream, bustling, resurgent Warsaw. Through the very heart of Poland's capital runs a street that may be the world's most perfect avenue, said Thomas Swick in National Geographic Traveler. Infinitely cozier than New York's Fifth Avenue, and much more varied than Paris's regimented Champs-Élysées, Krakowski Przemyśl goes beyond being a thoroughfare. To me, the street is Poland distilled, a parade of history, life, and indefatigable spirit that captures why this once dreary city is attracting more residents and visitors every year. Warsaw was, after all, razed by the Nazis and rebuilt by a communist regime, as tragic a fate as a city could have. But that grim past is decades behind now, and today's Warsaw feels reborn. Varsovians clearly excel at rebuilding. Two popular tourist destinations, Old Town and New Town, are both mid-20th century facsimiles of former city centers, the first dating to the 1200s, the second lovingly rebuilt to look the way it did in its 18th century prime. Both attract criticism for being Disney-esque, but on a recent return visit, I marvel anew at how exquisitely detailed the reproduction work is. These neighborhoods feel lived in, too. The owner of one art gallery tells me that many of her Old Town neighbors are artists, actors, or writers. A short stroll from her shop brings me to bustling Market Square, and a folk art gallery displaying painted wood carvings of religious figures, each one expressing a mixture of piety and humor that strikes me as particularly Polish. The city's new Copernicus Science Center, named after Poland's great 16th century astronomer, packs in so many hands-on displays that it has the air of a funhouse. But Warsaw is also a city of remembrances, so no visitor should miss the Warsaw Rising Museum, which vividly memorializes the citizens' valiant yet doomed uprising against Nazi occupation. One can't begin to understand present-day Warsaw without an appreciation of this event, which cost some 140,000 lives. The museum opened to much fanfare a decade ago, in part because it confirmed that Poland has regained its freedom and with it possession of its national narrative. A train tour of Western Canada. A two-day excursion on a private railway offers the best possible way to see the outlandishly scenic, hypnotically serene Canadian Rockies, said Chris Erskine in the Los Angeles Times. Even in 2013, travel on the Rocky Mountaineer Railway, rockymountaineer.com, feels like a bit of indulgence, complete with tablecloths and fresh orchids, and an attentive staff always ready to freshen the coffees. But during our 600-mile trip across British Columbia and up and over the Continental Divide, we mostly kept our eyes on the wilderness outside our glass-domed car. Once we reached the mountains, there were almost too many thrashing waterfalls, too many forests, too many vistas that looked as though they'd never been hiked. Grizzlies, elk, and moose roamed the land, but the celebrities of the animal kingdom were the dozen or so bald eagles we spotted. Those 2 days and 600 miles passed quickly. The afterglow lasts for weeks. Summer on a Texas ranch. This summer, I finally cured myself of Texas ranch phobia, said Christopher M. Kelly in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. For years after I moved to Texas from the Northeast, I couldn't understand why anyone would want to spend a summer vacation on a hot ranch in the middle of nowhere. But my attitude changed after my partner and I spent 2 nights at the Double S Ranch about 100 miles east of Dallas. My first impression of the community nearest the 800-acre working ranch was that it resembled a horror movie set. Remote, eerily quiet, strangely absent of people. Passing through the ranch's gates, though, we entered a picture postcard vision with a placid blue lake surrounded by trees and rustic cabins. We soon fell into a routine of walking in the woods, cycling, swimming, and playing the board games at our cabin. Before we arrived, we'd feared getting bored. By the end of the week, we were already plotting our return. We'll take a look now at the business section. The news at a glance. Media. Bezos buys the Washington Post. Amazon.com founder Jeffrey Bezos has snapped up the Washington Post, said Christine Hoffney in the New York Times. Bezos agreed to pay $250 million for the newspaper whose reporting helped topple a president and inspired a generation of journalists, and will own the Post in a personal capacity. Despite the paper's declining revenues, industry insiders were shocked this week when Washington Post Company CEO and Chairman Donald Graham announced the deal at a staff meeting. As the newspaper business continues to bring up questions to which we have no answers, he said, we began to ask ourselves if our small public company was still the best home for the newspaper. The Post wasn't the only media property to change hands last week, said David Vondrell in Time.com. The New York Times Company announced it was selling the Boston Globe to Red Sox owner John Henry for $70 million, a steep markdown from the $1.1 billion it paid for the paper in 1993. And Troubled Newsweek, which was sold in 2010 to billionaire Sidney Harmon for $1, was on the block, too. The Newsweekly, which merged the DailyBeast.com and last year dropped its print edition, is now owned by IBT Media, publisher of the International Business Times. Tech news, Obama vetoes Apple ban. The Obama administration has overturned a ban on the sale of older iPhones and iPads, said Diane Bartz and Ayesha Rasko in Reuters.com. The surprising move came 2 months after the U.S. International Trade Commission banned the models for infringing a Samsung patent. U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman lifted that ban last week, citing its effect on competitive conditions in the U.S. economy and the effect on U.S. consumers. Apple praised the administration for standing up for innovation, and Samsung said it was disappointed. Time Warner blacks out CBS. CBS and Time Warner Cable are on the outs, said Alex Ben Block in HollywoodReporter.com. after negotiations between the two companies broke down last week. The nation's second-largest cable company blacked out CBS stations in more than 3 million U.S. homes. The conflict hinges on CBS's demand for higher retransmission fees, which TWC said would set an expensive precedent. The cable company's action may encourage satellite providers carrying CBS stations, such as DirecTV and Dish, to aggressively go after TWC customers. Business crime? Ex-Goldman trader guilty of fraud. A federal jury last week convicted an ex-Goldman Sachs trader of defrauding investors in a mortgage deal, said Justin Baer, Chad Bray, and Gene Eaglesham in the Wall Street Journal. Fabrice Tour, who once went by the nickname Fabulous Fab, was found guilty on 6 of 7 charges that he intentionally misled investors and aided and abetted an alleged fraud by Goldman. While a judge still needs to sign off on Tour's punishment, a spokesman for the Securities and Exchange Commission said it would seek financial penalties and a ban on Tour's participation in the financial services industry. The government sues Bank of America. The Justice Department and the SEC both sued Bank of America this week, accusing the bank of fleecing investors by selling $850 million in iffy mortgage-backed securities, said Tom Schoenberg and Phil Mattingly in Bloomberg.com. The civil suits lay out a pattern of intentional attacks by bank officials to disguise the mortgage risks. The government complaints say the bank cut corners in scrutinizing the mortgages, in part to save about $15,000 in expenses, and failed to follow its own standard while vetting borrowers' income and assets. A fade-out for CD players. Automakers are hitting eject on their cars' compact disc players, said Chris Woodyard and Kelsey Mays in USA Today. Despite more convenient ways to bring music to cars, CD players have stubbornly endured, but perhaps not for much longer. Manufacturers are beginning to banish them from dashboards and hide them in spaces often more associated with parking meter change or packages of tissues. Devices such as iPods and smartphones have pulled even with the CD players for drivers, and automotive designers are happy to lose the cumbersome disc slots. They're already using the space it occupied for larger center stack screens and better ventilation for air conditioning ducts. If you don't have to worry about this CD player brick, you have much more flexibility, said Klaus Buss, Chrysler's interior design chief. And the business issue of the week, the rise of a part-time economy. I hate to sound happy over the underwhelming July employment number, said John Crudell in the New York Post, but I told you so. While experts had predicted that 175,000 new jobs would be created last month, the Labor Department released figures last week showing just 162,000 new jobs. On the bright side, the unemployment rate fell to 7.4% from 7.6%. That's great news, right? Well, not when you consider that unemployment is only going down because more people have given up on looking for a job altogether. And that's hardly the worst of it. Not only did the economy fail to add enough new jobs, but the government also had to reduce by 26,000 the number of jobs it originally thought were created in May and June. Overall, the economy still stinks, said Josh Boak in thefiscaltimes.com. If you need proof that this recovery is anemic, consider this. Hourly wages fell by 2 cents in July, and the average work week was shorter, too. And more than half of the jobs added were in retail, restaurants, and hospitality. These numbers point toward a larger and disturbing trend. We're creating an economy full of low-paid, part-time workers while we face a stagnation in the manufacturing jobs that President Obama has so often bragged about creating. At least we're creating jobs for the 34th month in a row, said Ninhai Singh in Fortune. But it's true that the bulk of those jobs is neither highly paid nor full-time work. Even if we haven't yet entirely become an economy of retail and restaurant workers, the increasing share of such jobs makes for a troubling trend. Our economy depends on consumer spending, and if Americans are taking less home in their paychecks each week, they have fewer dollars to pump back into the economy at the checkout counter. Most part-time or temporary jobs also offer no health or retirement benefits and little, if any, job security. And when workers aren't sure how much or where they might work tomorrow or next year, they're less likely to spend. The right loves to think that Obamacare is to blame, said Timothy Noah in MSNBC.com. But these numbers undermine that theory. The argument is that large employers are favoring part-time hires over full-time hires, full-time ones, so they can avoid the Obamacare mandate to provide health insurance to employees who work 30 hours or more per week. But on July 2nd, that employer mandate was postponed to 2015. If the mandate were really the biggest factor for employers, the number of part-time workers would likely have fallen last month, not risen. It's beyond dispute that part-time and temporary employment are currently higher than they should be. But the July numbers suggest that factors besides the specter of Obamacare are at work. Maybe the employer mandate boogeyman will prove to be a factor in the future. But for now, a more likely cause for the uptick in part-timers is the furloughing of federal employees because of the sequester. Either way, the new numbers aren't much to celebrate. Here's a business column from Matthew Iglesias in Slate.com. No family company can last forever, said Matthew Iglesias. In all the gnashing of teeth this week over the sale of the Washington Post to Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, many seem to have forgotten that the Graham family, which has been tied to that august newspaper for four generations, has long since had to answer to the shareholders of the publicly traded Washington Post Company. Rather than worrying about the possible trampling of American democracy by egomaniacal newspaper-buying billionaires, we should recognize that unshackling the Post from its publicly traded parent might be good for all concerned. The Washington Post Company can't forever cover the paper's losses instead of paying more dividends to its investors. The newspaper will benefit from Bezos' proven patience and his deep pockets, without the short-term demands of stockholders. It is true that many of the nation's most prestigious newspapers made their mark under the stewardship of families, like the Grahams, who believed in journalism more than profit. The newspaper business has long depended on bigwigs more interested in challenge and prestige than pure profit maximization. But it's only natural that it would need some new bigwigs once in a while. In another column from Reuters.com, Jeffrey Goldfarb and Grace Dye. The Magic Kingdom is running out of magic, said Jeffrey Goldfarb and Grace Dye. The House of Mouse has been betting on big brands like Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm's Star Wars franchise. For the most part, investors seem pleased. The company's stock regularly trades at stock market valuation higher than those of its competitors. But shareholders should be more skeptical. Disney shelled out $7.4 billion for the Pixar Animation Studio in 2006 in an effort to revive its sagging movie division. Disney insists that Pixar's current value far exceeds its acquisition price, but crunching the numbers suggests otherwise. add up the cash that comes from ticket sales, merchandise, DVDs, and TV, and Pixar is really just worth about $5.2 billion, or about two-thirds of what Disney paid. Yet by insisting that it can work magic through acquisitions, Disney seems to have put its shareholders under a spell. And its recent decision to pony up $8 billion for Marvel's stable of superheroes and a new set of Star Wars sequels shows that Disney has no desire to slow down. Shareholders be damned. Disney's strategy might pay off short-term at the box office, but those high-priced deals may disappoint investors in the long term. And here's a Making Money article called Money, a Pattern of Sloppy Credit Reports. Now, will credit agencies finally figure out how to stop making egregious errors in people's credit reports? Asked Tara Siegel Bernard in the New York Times. Last week, a federal district court in Oregon awarded Julie Miller a whopping $18.4 million in punitive damages after Miller sued Equifax for failing to remove a host of errors from her credit report. The credit bureau mixed up Miller's credit history with that of another woman of the same name and wouldn't set things straight despite the 13 letters Miller sent over 2 years before finally filing suit. The agency's indifference should surprise no one who has ever tried to deal with any of the three big credit reporting agencies, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. Experts say credit bureaus tolerate these errors and the hefty settlements they pay to aggrieved consumers as a cost of doing business. They'd rather err by putting inaccurate information in your report than miss a single possible credit failing. If you think Miller's victory will teach them a lesson, you are a lot more optimistic than close observers of the industry. Yet, as Miller's case showed, credit report errors can have serious consequences, said Kathy Kristoff in CBSNews.com. They can affect consumers' ability to get loans, secure other lines of credit, and get approved for jobs or apartments. Regulators say that more than one-fifth of the credit reports contain errors. If you suspect or spot an error on your own, start by getting a free copy from annualcreditreport.com. Then write to the agency, simply noting that inaccuracies on a copy of the report, and attach copies of any documents that might back up your claim. Send your correction request by certified mail and request a return receipt to prove that the agency received your letter. Bureaus are supposed to respond within 30 days, and if that doesn't happen, well, you might have to follow Miller's example and sue. We need tougher regulations to give consumers the legal tools to force correction, said the Tampa Bay Times in an editorial. Legislators should provide regulators with the muscle they need to hold credit bureaus accountable by imposing higher standards for putting information into credit files in the first place. They should require credit agencies to match Social Security numbers, which would reduce the mixing of strangers' data, and they should clearly lay out what steps an agency must take to reasonably investigate a dispute. We don't need more lawsuits, but rather stronger laws that will finally give consumers power over their own information. We'll take a look today at an obituary. This one from Berthold Beitz, 1913 to 2013. The German industrialist who saved Jews. The life of Berthold Beitz is the stuff of German legend. As head of the steel giant Krupp, he played a crucial role in rebuilding post-war West Germany into an industrial powerhouse. During the Cold War, he acted as an unofficial envoy between East and West, once meeting with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev for a chat that went on for 21 hours. Yet Beitz will also be remembered for his heroic efforts to save hundreds of Jews and Poles from the Nazis while stationed in Poland during World War II. Beitz didn't set out to join the ranks of genteel rescuers known as the Righteous Among the Nations, a title bestowed on him in 1973 by Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem, said the Washington Post. He came from a family of Nazi sympathizers, according to accounts of his life, and at the outbreak of the war was working for Royal Dutch Shell in Hamburg as an oil executive. His experience led to his appointments as business manager of the Carpathian Oil Company in the Polish town Borislaw in what is now Ukraine. Many of the company's workers were Jews. Beitz began to rescue work out of purely humane moral motives, he said, recalling that he felt compelled to act after seeing a Jewish mother with her child in her arms being shot. Using his connections with Nazi officials, as well as what he described as self-assurance and incredible luck, Beitz ended up saving as many as 800 Jews. He pulled company employees and others from trains heading to the death camps, claiming they were essential to the oil field's operation. I chose tailors, hairdressers, and Talmudic scholars and gave them all cards as petroleum technicians, he said. Meanwhile, Beitz and his wife risked their own lives by hiding dozens of Jews in the cellar of their family home and warning others of impending deportation, said the Daily Telegraph. Beitz resumed his business career after the war as president of Iduna, then West Germany's 16th largest insurance company. Using modern business methods, such as bonuses and staff competitions, he rapidly expanded the company into the nation's third largest insurer. His success caught the eye of Alfred Krupp, then 45 and the sole owner of the Krupp Steel Company, said the New York Times. Krupp had recently left prison after serving part of a 12-year sentence for war crimes, including using slave labor, and needed someone with a clean reputation to rebrand the business and restore a sense of purpose in its demoralized workforce. Beitz was appointed chairman in 1953 and used his unusual management approach to reorganize Krupp and regain its vast markets. His reputation for integrity, earned during the war, won him the confidence of Eastern European leaders, enabling him to help West Germany renew business and diplomatic ties severed by the war. Beitz, who retired in 1990, liked to brag that he was the last of the steel barons, yet he never boasted about his wartime experiences, said his grandson Robert Ziff. Instead, he gathered letters that he'd received from survivors and bound them in a book, which he gave to his family. He let that do the talking, said Ziff. And here in a section called the Book List, we have an article, Best Books Chosen by Matthew Berry. Matthew Berry is the host of ESPN's Emmy Award-winning show Fantasy Football Now. His first book, the current bestseller Fantasy Life, profiles several hardcore devotees of fantasy sports. And here are a few of the books that he likes. Moneyball by Michael Lewis. With sports, you've got to look at statistics all the time. But what's so brilliant about Moneyball is the way Michael Lewis tells the story behind the stats. It's not a numbers book. It's a book about the people who use the numbers. It resonated with me in a big way. He also likes Private Parts by Howard Stern. I'm a huge Howard Stern fan, but even if you don't appreciate his edgy sense of humor, you've got to give him credit for being an unbelievably smart businessman. His memoir brilliantly mixes stories from his radio show with his rise from working as a small-town morning DJ to national fame. He also likes Live from New York by Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller. This 2002 book about Saturday Night Live is told from several perspectives. The writers, the producers, the performers. I can't imagine the work that went into weaving all of these stories together to make a cohesive history of the show. you won't find a book that's more fun to read. The Princess Bride by William Goldman, my all-time favorite book, has something for everyone. Romance, action, danger, revenge, justice, comedy, Goldman's novel transports you to a completely different world, but you totally buy in because he's exploring such universal themes. The Myron Bolitar series by Harlan Coben. Anything Harlan Coben writes is a must-read for me, but I especially love his Myron Bolitar series. Myron's a sports agent, so the world of sports takes center stage. An underlying theme in all of Coben's books, however, is the length to which people will go to protect their families. I'm sorry, that was Coben, C-O-B-E-N, not Cohen. And finally, The Complete Adventures of Curious George by Margaret and H.A. Ray. As a kid, I loved the Curious George books, and to this day, I'm still fascinated by them. No joke, my office is covered in Curious George memorabilia. My parents used to call me Curious George because I was always asking so many questions, a trait that served me well as I was writing my own book. Here's a quote from the Wit and Wisdom section. Every person needs to take one day away, a day in which one consciously separates the past from the future, a day in which no problems are confronted, no solutions are searched for. That's from Maya Angelou, quoted in Real Simple. And on that note, we've run out of time for today's program, episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. I hope you've enjoyed this diversion going a little deeper into the magazine. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.